You want a story?
Yes.
You want a story, Kelly? Okay, listen. Grandma will probably read you a story, okay? I'm sure she will. But why don't you get the other kids outside, okay? Go outside and see if they want to come inside, and Grandma will read a story, okay? All right, go get them.
Right, left, right,
Grandma, and okay, kids, come on. Get in here, hurry. Awesome. We're going to get Grandma to tell us a story. Grandma!
Yes?
The kids want you to come in here and tell a story. You got time?
How about reading a story, not just telling a story?
Reading a story, that sounds good.
Alright, if everybody's kind of quiet, gather around and I'll read a story.
Fantastic, here we go.
Hi, boys and girls. This is Grandma again. We're reading about Jesus and his last night in Gethsemane. "Jesus of Nazareth," they cried, not recognizing him in the darkness. "I am he," said Jesus. At this, the whole crowd fell to the ground in terror. Perhaps it was the light shining from his face that frightened them, or the presence of the angel who had strengthened him. Presently, Judas staggered to his feet and to where Jesus was standing. "Hail, Master," he said, and kissed him. This was the sign he had agreed on with the rabbis. "The one I shall kiss is the man," he had told them. "Seize him." "Friend, why are you here?" asked Jesus. "Would you betray the Son of Man with a kiss?" Now the ruffians were surging forward again, angry that they had let themselves be scared by this one unarmed man. Hands reached out to grab him. Peter came running up. "Shall we strike with the sword?" he cried, and before Jesus could stop him, the big fisherman had brought his weapon down on the head of Malchus, one of the high priest's servants, lopping off his right ear. The man yelled in agony and put up his hand to stop the flow of blood. But another hand got there first, crying, "No more of this." Jesus touched the wound, healing it at once. When the man felt the place to see what had happened, he found his ear restored as it had been before. The miracle gave Jesus a few more moments of freedom. Turning to Peter, he said, "Put your sword back into its place, for all who take the sword shall perish by the sword. Do you think that I cannot appeal to my Father, and he will at once send me more than 12 legions of angels? But how then should the scriptures be fulfilled, that it must be so?" Of course, he could have called the angels to save him, and how glad they would have been to come. Tens of thousands would have come sweeping down the sky at a single word, but he wouldn't speak that word. It would have upset the whole plan of salvation and made all the great prophecies of the Messiah meaningless. Now he turned on the mob and rebuked them for coming out to arrest him with swords and clubs as if he were a common thief. "Day after day I sat in the temple teaching," he said. "You did not seize me. But all this has taken place that the scriptures of the prophets might be fulfilled." How important those old scriptures were to him. But the crowd wasn't listening. Already the soldiers were binding his hands so that they may lead him as a prisoner to the high priest. Thinking more of his disciples than of himself, Jesus said, "If I am the one you want, let these men go." But he did not have to say this. They had already gone. Taking advantage of the darkness, they had scattered in all directions. They all forsake him and fled. Just where all the disciples went that night, we do not know. Some may have gone to nearby Bethany to break the awful news to Lazarus, Mary, and Martha. Others may have taken cover on the wooden hillside till danger was past. So far as we know, only Peter and John kept up with the mob as it hurried Jesus back to the city. John, who had friends in the high priest's palace, managed to get inside and watch the trial of his beloved master. Peter, afar off, but when he arrived, John got him into the servants' quarters, where he ran into a lot of trouble. The story John tells us is a very sad one. Jesus was taken first to Ananias, then to Caiaphas, who presided over the Sanhedrin, the governing body of Israel at that time. Evidently, some of its members were waiting for Jesus when he was brought in. Others hurried to the palace as soon as they knew he had been captured. It was illegal to hold a trial in the middle of the night, but so great was the hatred of the Jews and of the rabbis for Jesus that they were ready to break their own laws to get rid of him. Most likely, the chief reason for the night trial was that they wanted to have it all over before the people who loved Jesus found out what had been done. If he were already condemned to death, what could anybody do about it? You know, so often we hear that the Romans were the ones that killed Jesus and took him to trial. But in reality, it was the Jews and it was the Jewish rabbis. If only there had been a few children about, I'm sure they would have done what they could to help. One of them at least would have called out, "Leave him alone, he's our friend." But alas, they were all in bed. So there stood Jesus alone and friendless in the midst of the rabbis. How they hated him. And they hate him today. They were jealous because he was so popular with the common people. They were envious of his power to heal the sick. They were angry because the truth and the beauty of his teaching showed up the foolishness of theirs. Now they had him where they wanted him, and they would never let him go. There was no chance for fair play at such a trial. Jesus was as good as condemned before he got there. The Jews began by asking Jesus about his disciples and his teaching, suggesting that he was trying to form a secret society. Jesus said there was nothing secret about his work. I have spoken openly to the world. I have always taught in the churches and the temples where all of Israel came together. I have said nothing secretly. Why do you ask me? Ask those who have heard me. What I said to them, they know what I said. At this, one of the officers standing by struck Jesus with his hand, saying, "Is that how you answer the high priests, the rabbis?" With wonderful patience, Jesus kept calm and respectful. "If I have spoken wrongly, bear witness to the wrong," he said. "But if I have spoken rightly, why do you strike me?" Now false witnesses were called in to say that Jesus had said and done things that were wrong, but they didn't agree. One contradicted another. The trial was getting nowhere. Then two men came forward and declared, "This fellow said, I am able to destroy the temple of God and build it in 3 days." "What have you say to this?" asked the high priest and the rabbis. Jesus did not reply. He had said something like this, but not about the temple these men were thinking about. He had meant the temple of his body, that he would rise up in 3 days after his death. But what was the use of telling these people? They wouldn't understand. "Have you no answer to make?" roared the high priest. "What is it that these men testify against you?" Still Jesus kept silent, and all the cruel mob wondered. Having no more witnesses, the high priests and the rabbis decided he must try to get Jesus to condemn himself. Rising to his feet, he cried, "I adjure you by the living God, tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God." Jesus had to answer now, for he couldn't deny his divinity or his mission, though it meant his death. "You have said so," he said calmly, which was the same as saying yes. Then he added, "I tell you hereafter, you will see the Son of Man seated on the right hand of power and coming on the clouds of heaven." At this, the high priest tore his robes in fury. "He has uttered blasphemy," he shrieked. "Why do we still need witnesses? You have heard his blasphemy. What is your judgment?" He deserves death, cried the rabbis. They would have killed him right then had they dared, but they couldn't put anyone to death without permission of the Roman governor, so they sent him bound to Pilate. While Jesus waited, men sped on him and struck him. Someone covered his head with a sack while the mob sneered. "Prophesy to us, you Christ, who is it that struck you?" Meanwhile, in the servants' hall, Peter had been having a hard time too. As he warmed his hands by the fire, one of the maids said to him, "Weren't you also with Jesus of Galilee?" "No," said Peter, "never saw the man." As the maid went away, a cock crowed, but Peter was too worried to notice it. A little later, another servant came over to him, and after taking a good look, said to those who were standing around, "This fellow was with Jesus of Nazareth. He's the one who cut off Malchus's ear." "I don't know what you're talking about," cried Peter with an oath. But the others were not satisfied. They said, "You are a Galilean. Your accent betrays you. You are one of them." At this, Peter began to curse and to swear, saying, "I am not. I don't know anything about him." Just then the cock crowed again, and Peter remembered how Jesus had said to him, "Before the cock crows twice, you will deny me 3 times. Suddenly looking up, he caught sight of Jesus, his hands bound and marks of suffering on his face. And the Lord turned and looked upon Peter. Their eyes met. Peter was all broken up. Leaping to his feet in shame and sorrow, he rushed outside and wept bitterly. Hearing that Jesus had been condemned to death, Judas suddenly felt sorry for what he had done. He wished he had never taken those 30 pieces of silver. He would return them. Perhaps if the Jews got their money back, they would set Jesus free. But it was too late. They didn't want the money. Rushing in before them, he cried, "I have sinned in betraying innocent blood." "What is that to us?" they sneered. "See to it yourself." Judas meant nothing to the rabbis now. He had done the job they had wanted him to do, and now they were ready to push him out of their way. "Here's your money," cried Judas, throwing the coins at them. Then, as the silver pieces scattered over the marble floor, he ran from the palace out into the darkened, deserted streets to the city gate, perhaps the very gate through which Jesus was to pass later that very day. Somewhere beyond it, alone, ashamed, and terrified, he found a tree, and he hung himself. It's worth remembering that both Judas and Jesus died the same day. Both died on trees. One died by his own hand, the other by the hand of the Jews and the rabbis. One died a traitor, the other a hero. One helped nobody by his death, the other saved our people, the Israel people of God. Back at the palace, the priest looked at the 30 pieces of silver on the floor and decided to pick them up. But they were puzzled what to do with them. "This is blood money," they said. "We can't put it back in the treasury." So they called a committee meeting, decided to use it to buy the potter's field to bury strangers in. It was still called the Field of Blood when years later Matthew wrote his gospel. Meanwhile, Jesus was being pushed and dragged in the midst of a jeering mob to the home of the Roman governor. It was early in the morning when they arrived there. I'm sure Pilate was not at all pleased at being disturbed at such an hour. He must have wondered, too, why the priests and the rabbis couldn't wait for their prisoners to be judged at a proper time. As for Jesus, he must have been very, very tired. He hadn't slept since Wednesday night, and it was now Friday morning. Hour after hour he had stood before his tormentors, being slapped, beaten, and spit upon. Since his arrest in Gethsemane, he had had no food, no rest, not even one comforting word from a single friendly soul. Yet he had uttered no word of complaint or talked back in anger to those who had treated him so shamefully. He was like a lamb that is led to the slaughter, and like a sheep that before its shearers is dumb, so he opened not his mouth. Because it was Passover time, the Jews would not go into Pilate's judgment hall. They thought they would defile themselves, as though they hadn't done that already, by laying hands on the sacred person of the Son of God. So they stayed outside, and Jesus went in alone with his Roman guard. Pilate looked at the prisoner and was much surprised. He had expected to see a violent criminal, not a quiet, dignified man like this. There must have been a mistake, he thought, and went out to speak with the chief priests. "Okay, I'll see you again tomorrow, and we'll find out how the trial goes. I love you all. Bye."
Today, we are living in a culture in which the government, our political leaders, and even our so-called church leaders have animosity and hatred toward our people. That is why there is an aggressive attempt to destroy everything that will remind our people of their glorious past. But as sons and daughters of God, we have a duty to ourselves, a duty to our forefathers, and a duty to our children to continue to be missionaries in order to proclaim a message of hope and deliverance for white Christian America. We are not here to hate anyone. We are here to love our people and to be a beacon of light to those who are searching. This message is brought to you by Rachel Pendergraft and The White Side.
Georgetown law professor Louis Michael Seidman says that the U.S. Constitution is archaic and downright evil. And people like this are teaching in America's law schools? It's frightening. Well, here's your chance to listen to one attorney who stands on principle and fights for the dreams of freedom-loving Americans. Listen to Jason Robb, host of Cross Examine, each week right here on KKK Radio.
Gay Pride Days, school assemblies, posters on the wall. It's in our face every day. What's a white Christian teen to do? And does anyone really care? Listen each week to White Youth Focus, where teens discuss the propaganda war against them. Moderated by caring and thoughtful white Christian activists, Billy and Charity. Because it's okay to be white and proud.